Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Deadhead Cannabis Show. I'm Larry Mishkin of Mishkin Law in Chicago with my co-host Rob Hunt today from California. Our other co-host Jim Marty is taking the day off as he is busy traveling. We hope he travels safe, and we will look forward to speaking with him next week. This is a great show, folks. We've got great stuff to talk about today, some big happenings in the marijuana and hemp world, which we'll be leading off with. But today, the day that you're listening to the show, if you're listening to the date that this is dropped on November 15th, is a very, very significant day in Grateful Dead history as it marks the anniversary of the release of one of the most famous Grateful Dead albums of all time, Shakedown Street. Hard to believe, but 43 years ago, the age of Disco Dead was born, and we will be doing a deep dive into Shakedown Street, how it was produced, how it all came together, who played a role in it, because there's some big names in the rock and roll world involved with Shakedown Street, and ultimately the impact that it had on the band and the Deadheads and all of that. And then we will also, because we're big on these kind of things today, November 15th marks the 50th anniversary of the Grateful Dead's performance in Austin, Texas. It's a show that's been released by the Grateful Dead as part of their Road Trips series, Volume 3, Number 2, from November 15th, 1971 in Austin. There's a great story about why the Dead didn't ever want to play in Texas, but finally agreed that they would come and play in Austin. It's an amazing show. But it's got some really, really great points on there that we will be talking about and listening to as we go ahead today. But let's dive into this cannabis stuff first, because there's some really interesting stuff going on here. Rob, how are you doing today?
I'm great, Larry. There's so much to go through today. And obviously, I love discussing Shakedown Street because I'm a big fan of the Disco Dead era and huge fan of a lot of the songs on that album. So it had some misses, but it also had some ones that I love listening to this day, and super fired up about the 71 show as well. But let's talk cannabis to start with, because there is a lot to get through.
Absolutely. So recently we had the DEA issue a letter to the Alabama Board of Pharmacy in Birmingham, Alabama, asking a question, and the question basically was, is Delta 8 considered a controlled substance, and is it subject to the provisions of the Controlled Substance Act? The interesting thing is both the fact that Alabama is asking the question, I suppose, although maybe we shouldn't be surprised it's Alabama asking the question, but the response that's given to the question by Terrence L. Booz from the Drug and Chemical Evaluation Section, the division of the Diversion Control Division, is very interesting. Rob, can you kind of set the background for this for us?
Yeah, sure can. Going back about a year, on August 21st of 2020, the Drug Enforcement Agency came out with a interim final rule, which is, you know, not law, but it was asking for an interpretation on certain things, and they made an interpretation on four different points. But one of them was with respect to what is legal coming out of the Farm Bill. And the position they took at the time is, you know, that Delta 8 and Delta 9 THC are still illegal as per, you know, the letter of the law, and they're still considered to be part of the tetrahydrocannabinol family that would be THC and still illegal under the Controlled Substances Act. And this is before, you know, D8 was really, really popular. So for those of you out there that don't know what Delta 8 THC is, think of it as like, you know, Delta 9. Think of it as THC light. It's sort of the less stringent or less potent cousin to Delta 9. So, you know, if Delta 9 gets you 100% high, then Delta 8 gets you about 35% high. A lot of people say it comes with less anxiety. It comes with, you know, kind of a mellower high. But it's still psychotropic. So what's been happening out there is that people have been extracting hemp, which is technically legal under the Farm Bill. As long as you're below 0.03% THC on a dry weight basis, then your crop is considered to be hemp. If you're above 0.03%, then you're considered to be cannabis or marijuana. So hemp is legal. It's legal everywhere. It was removed from the Controlled Substances Act completely in the 2018 Farm Bill. And when it was, there was a great deal of question at the time of, okay, does that mean that anything that's now derived from hemp is legal? Because technically hemp, you know, gave a definition of what it is. The Congress, you know, put it into the Farm Bill and carved it away from the Controlled Substances Act. At that point in time, you know, the FDA chairman, Scott Gottlieb, went in front of Congress and said, hey, guys, I don't know if you know what you just did, but you just legalized all phytocannabinoids out of hemp. Well, at the time, no one really thought anything of it, at least congressional lawmakers didn't, because they didn't have any idea that you could extract the hemp plant and take, you know, a ton of it and end up with a still very meaningful quantity of, you know, CBD, THC, CBN, etc. But the important one being THC, anything in the THC family. So for a year plus, you know, about 13 months, everyone's been asking this question. And I know people from your former firm did, Larry, and people from my firm did. And I actually wrote a white paper on it that you guys can see if you go to my LinkedIn profile. I did a paper called The DEA Has It Wrong Again. But my position on it was the DEA's interim final rule got it dead wrong specifically because what they were saying was not law. What Congress said was they couldn't usurp congressional authority to make their own rules. So essentially what they were opining is what we call in the law dicta, which is, you know, it's nice as a guide, but it's not law. So this is the first time the DEA came out and admitted that they are wrong in that interim final rule. So that hopefully sets the stage, but, you know, let's discuss for a minute because this has got major implications.
That's a great point you made, Rob, and it's a great explanation of the background of everything for our listeners. And it does raise some very, very big, important points here. And the biggest, most important point, I think, is the government's efforts to try to regulate something that they don't know very much about. And this is a big problem in the industry all the way around. And the part that really upsets me the most about it is not so much that we had cultivators and supporters of legalized hemp who said, oh, you know, tried to mislead Congress. This is a situation where Congress didn't do its homework and Congress didn't sit down and Congress didn't check it out. And the reason Congress didn't do this is because they've never been able to do it. By law, they're prohibited from going forward and educating any of themselves on this. They can't do officially funded government testing. They can't do. So they sit there. It's kind of like the FDA saying, we've never heard of a CBD edible before. My gosh, we can't possibly authorize this. We never even knew these existed. It's this willful ignorance about the whole thing that really bothers me. So now you have first the government saying, okay, yes, fine, go forward. And yes, hemp that is 0.3% or less and its constituent cannabinoids are all considered to be non-scheduled products. They're not on the controlled substance schedule. They're not considered illegal by the federal government. It's basically the same approach the government has to alcohol. So now we have all of this, but all of a sudden we start to run into a problem because people who were in the know and people who have become in the know in the industry, like you say, have discovered all of these different things that can be done with hemp, different cannabinoids that are being discovered and all sorts of things. And the truth is that there's probably much, much more still hidden in the plant that none of us know about yet. In my opinion is to really unlock all of it. It's going to require a legalization because I think we're going to start to ultimately need the type of financial resources and technology that Big Pharma has. You know, whatever you're feeling about Big Pharma may be, if the idea behind CBD is to really make it a suitable medical product and really be able to maximize its potential, I just don't see where any individual, even big companies, will have the wherewithal to do that on the same level as Big Pharma. But again, you know, regardless of that point, there are a lot of people out there who are, as you say, extracting out of legal hemp. And a lot of what they've discovered is, and you're absolutely right, Bob Hoban of the Hoban Law Group has been preaching this for years, that truth of the matter is you can pull quite a bit of THC out of what is otherwise legalized hemp. That means that the hemp overall is measured is 0.3% or less. But when you start extracting out of there, whether it's Delta 9, whether it's Delta 8, whatever you might be extracting out of there, if you stockpile it and put it all together, yes, you can really have something that's a lot stronger. You know, I think that when we come out at the end of the day is, at least for right now, I appreciate the fact that the FDA is willing, the DEA is willing to acknowledge that hemp is legal and that hemp is therefore, hemp and any of its constituent cannabinoids are basically off limits to them. And that's a very, very important public acknowledgement by them that we've been looking for a long time, because you never were quite sure with the DEA, especially, as you pointed out, Rob, its own version of, you know, independent rulemaking separate and apart from what the Constitution might say. But I think that this is big. I think it's good. And I think that, you know, this will allow people, this Delta 8 being as popular as it's becoming, this will now give manufacturers and distributors the same level of confidence that they have when they sell CBD, knowing that it's been certified as coming from a plant with 0.3% or less.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, for the lay people out there that don't know this issue nearly as well as we do, Larry, you know, the analogy I try to give to people out there is that, you know, if you want to get, if you want gold, the best way to get it is from a gold mine. You know, you go in, you extract, because that's where the highest concentrations of gold are. Well, if you want THC, then you go to, you know, the marijuana plant where it's, you know, a 25-30% THC plant. But if you want gold, you can still get it from a copper mine. You know, a copper mine, if you pulverize millions of pounds of rock, you're going to get a lot of copper out of there, but you're also going to get iridium, and you're going to get platinum, and you're going to get gold and silver. There are all these other trace metals in there that in a very, you know, if you were to pulverize a couple pounds of it, you're not going to get very much gold. But if you pulverize millions and millions of pounds of it, there's going to be a meaningful quantity in there that you're actually going to be able to extract and say, okay, well, let's, you know, figure out what to do with this as well. Well, that's what hemp is for THC. You know, it doesn't occur in very large quantities, but if you're actually extracting a ton of it. Now, the other thing that's really interesting, this is something that, you know, Congress never, ever considered, is that you can actually take CBD and convert CBD to THC Delta 8 and Delta 9. So if you're going to do that conversion process, then the question is whether or not that falls into the definition of being a synthetic. And if you're actually using an organic process to do it, then technically there's nothing synthetic about it. You're just changing the molecular structure of a molecule so that it moves it from being CBD being non-psychotropic to THC being psychotropic, but you're doing it in a way that doesn't you know, fall within a category of being synthetic in the process. So what we can expect here, you know, at least my takeaway is, if Congress actually fully realizes what the issue is now, then very likely they're going to go back and retroactively make a modification to the Farm Bill and say, okay, we need to fix this so that, you know, we don't want psychotropic controlled substances that would otherwise be controlled, you know, out there fueling into bodegas all over the country. And we've already seen the states act on this. We've already seen individual states, most of them have already tried to make Delta 8 illegal. I'd expect that they'd say Delta 9 is still illegal. But technically, you know, now we've got to ask ourselves, well, who's got the ability to do this? We've already seen that states can be less restrictive than the federal government in passing cannabis laws. And the question is, can they be more restrictive than the federal government? And I would argue that they probably can't. You know, usually the federal government is going to be the sort of the litmus test on this. If they want to be less restrictive, they can. If the federal government wants to pick it up and go down and slap the states around, they can, which they haven't done with cannabis. But in this case, are they going to say, hey, guys, this is not illegal by a federal standard? And can someone actually, you know, could one of our clients go out there and say, look, that's great you guys made it illegal at the state level, but it's legal at the federal level. So you can't tell me I can't make this. And that's what I'm waiting to see.
Well, you know, that's an interesting point. And that's a point, you know, we have to consider. You know, my take on it has always been that, you know, much like alcohol, the states are pretty much free to determine within their borders whether or not they want to approve and allow, right, hemp cultivation, hemp extraction, hemp processing. I think that they've been given a little bit of leeway with respect to that. My concern, where I see the issue coming up, is what happens when, because the second part of the hemp bill, in the 2018 Farm Bill, the second part of it is not just that it makes it legal, but that it expressly declares that no state may interfere with the interstate transportation. Now, if you're driving it from a processor in Washington to a customer in Illinois, and you can either drive 500 miles out of your way or you can go through Idaho, and the state of Idaho declares, not in our state, we say that this is illegal, and they pull you over, at that point, they've clearly crossed the line. Idaho doesn't seem to be bothered by that. So my advice to anyone is stay out of Idaho. At least for that purpose. But that's where it gets tricky. And I think that as, you know, you try and put together a patchwork of laws across the country on what states are going to do with hemp, we're going to see. Ultimately, I would like to think that states are the ones that aren't approving are acting irrationally, because for better or for worse, and it's easy for us to sit there and make faces about it, but people are afraid of what they don't know. People are afraid of what they think they know, even if it's not true. And there's such a huge education gap right now for the public, again, because the federal government for so long has prohibited any kind of education at all. I mean, you know, we have kids who go through all of our elementary school and high school public school systems and may not ever know that from the time the country was founded until the early 1900s, hemp was the largest cash crop in this country. And that in, during World War II, when Manila was blockaded, they had become our source of hemp. Illinois and Kentucky and a number of other states went back to hemp cultivation and once again got the United States all of the hemp it needs. This country has a very, very proud history with hemp. And that's always been based on the idea that it's hemp and it's not marijuana and people are using it for hemp-related purposes. I just think that back in the day, they either didn't have the understanding and certainly not the technology to be able to go in and pull the cannabinoids and the extracts out that we can now do. And ultimately, that's where things get tricky. And I think that puts a burden on the industry, Rob, that, you know, you have to have pure motives. If your idea is we're going to go in and sell you on this, but we're really going to treat it like that, then you know what? You better expect to get burned because eventually the government will catch up with it. You know, if you're going to say, look, we believe there's legitimate uses for CBD. We recognize that there can be some THC in it, but our goal is not, we don't endorse the idea of stockpiling that THC to create a kind of, I don't even know what it is. That's not black, not gray, whatever kind of market it is of THC reserves. You know, and I think it's up to the industry to declare for itself what its standards are and to enforce those standards among its members.
Yeah, I agree. And I don't think we've gotten to the bottom of this yet, and I think it's going to take some time before we actually do. And again, you know, lawmakers, don't always understand the question that they're being asked to opine on. I mean, we certainly have a far better understanding of this question than you know, any politician does. And even more so than probably 90% of the people in the cannabis industry. But with politicians, you know, they've got their own reasons for doing things. And as we saw again this week, some really good reporting coming out of both Forbes and coming out of Marijuana Moment, who broke the story that now the Republicans are trying to put a cannabis bill on the table. So, and by the way, a quick shout out to the guys at Marijuana Moment for, you know, those of you out there that don't know the work that Tom Engel and his team have been doing. They're breaking more and more stories than almost any other group out there on the cannabis front, and they're doing it with really accurate reporting coming out of D.C. So I don't know what their sources are or how they've ingratiated themselves so well to get some of these scoops, but they're scooping the New York Times, they're scooping the Journal, they're scooping Forbes, they're scooping everyone out there that's covering cannabis, and they're doing it really effectively. So, you know, hats off to those guys and the reporting they're doing.
I agree. Look, it would, you know, the industry, like any industry, can never have enough good media entities and companies that are interested in it. And, you know, MJ Business has always been there, now Marijuana Moment, and a number of these. And they do provide great resources for us, and they should for everyone else, too, because we have to be an educated public as to this right that's being given to us, so we make sure that we don't abuse it in a way that gives people motivation to try and take it away. Yeah, this Republican-led bill, Rob, we talked about this a little bit before the show, you know, I'm kind of split on it, right? On the one hand, great, you know, let's get marijuana legal. I'm never going to be one of these people who says, well, you know, gee, the Republicans made it legal, so therefore, you know, somehow it's lost its meaning to me. We've talked about the fact that people on both sides of the aisle are very big proponents of marijuana. And we've also talked about, and I think recognize the idea that probably the only reason that we don't have federally legally mandated marijuana at this moment is due to the otherwise tremendous partisan gridlock that goes on in Washington, D.C., where it's impossible to get the right to vote for a bill proposed by the left and impossible to get the left to vote for a bill proposed by the right. And while I never want to, suggest evil motives to anyone, I think it's probably more than just a coincidence, unfortunately, given what we see going on in Congress these days, that a Republican who felt strong enough about legalized marijuana to want to promote a bill didn't just simply agree to work on the bill that's already pending. And that's not to say that I want Schumer and the Democrats to get the credit. That's to say that if you have two competing bills, you're basically dividing your potential support now along party lines. And the beauty of marijuana is it's supposed to cross those party lines, But when a Democrat is given a choice to vote for a Republican bill or a Democrat bill, chances are they're going to vote party, as will a Republican. So what I'd really like to see is if the sponsors of the Republican bill and Schumer and his co-sponsors can't get together and figure out a way to just come up with one bipartisan bill and get the work done already.
Yeah, I agree with that. But what I'll say is that, you know, it doesn't matter what the House does. I think we both know that either bill is dead on arrival in the Senate. There aren't 60 votes right now to pass anything major. So anyone that actually really follows the industry politically understands that this is, you know, a distinction without a difference, because it's really not going to change, you know, anything the final result anyway. You know, what it has done, though, and this is kind of helpful to the industry, at least to the larger businesses, is it stemmed the tide of this really long, slow sell-off that's been happening in the public cannabis sector. So if you look at all the cannabis stock prices, you know, over the last 3 or 4 days since Marijuana Moment broke this story, it's been the first time since probably March where you've seen the share prices of these stocks go back up, and it's happening as they're going into earnings season. So everyone's sort of watching right now, and you're getting some great earnings reports. You know, Curaleaf just reported north of $300 million in top-line revenue in the last quarter, which is now a run rate of, you know, well north of $1 billion on an annualized basis. So you're getting a lot of people that are now taking notice. So sometimes a little bit of fanfare, doesn't matter, you know, what provides it, can be good for the industry if it gets a lot of people to notice what's happening in the industry and gets more acceptance into the industry and gets more retail investors taking a look at the space. So whether you're a supporter of like the mom and pop organizations, or you're a supporter of, you know, you're more of a safe investor with bigger stock names, it's still helpful to drive the process forward, to get us closer to legalization, which ultimately is the goal of, you know, both of us on the show. So we'll see. Well, with that, let's move over and talk a little Grateful Dead. I mean, obviously, like, we can talk politics and cannabis all day, but you're right. Shakedown Street came out 43 years ago now, and it's one for the ages. You get Fire on the Mountain coming out of that, Stagger Lee, Shakedown, I Need a Miracle, you know, a couple Donna tunes that not too many people talk about too much in From the Heart of Me, and what else is on there? France, I think, is that right? Then you had a couple, you know, random ones like Serengeti, but there was certainly, you know, a handful of pretty big tracks on there. You know, specifically for me, Fire and Shakedown are about as big as they come.
Well, I would say yes, in terms of, you know, presenting new Grateful Dead material. You know, clearly for me, Shakedown and Fire on the Mountain are the two major takeaways from this album. Yes, it launched I Need a Miracle, which has become a very strong Bobby standard. But it's interesting, right? Good Lovin' is a cover that they had been playing for years and years, and they finally threw on an album. And it's, you know, as far as albums go, I think it's a fine version. You know, what I learned about France was that France was not written by Donna. France was written by
Mickey
and Bobby and Hunter.
Maybe. And Hunter, that's right. Yep, it's the three of them.
And whether they wrote it, you know, for Donna to sing or not, she wound up singing a lot of it. And, you know, it's an interesting tune. Serengeti is pretty much a percussion piece.
Yeah, it's the Rhythm Devils.
Right, you know, doing their thing, and that's fantastic. From the Heart of Me is a great, great tune. I really love that tune. You know, Donna sings it really nice, and I have to say it's certainly a Donna-sung tune that's probably one that I like more than the others, although I've never heard it in concert and anything like that. And then you get Stagger Lee again, right? Stagger Lee is another old, you know, you can Google Stagger Lee. There's 50 different stories behind it. And here they are throwing it on an album in the height of the disco era. I love that they did that. That's a great tune.
Well, we've talked about Stagger Lee previously on the show. Yep. And one of the things that's great about Stagger Lee is it has, you know, it's very much a Caribbean Creole, you know, sort of junk canoe Bahamian song. But when you actually look at who is listed as the credits on the writing of this one, it's credited to Garcia and Hunter for the arrangement that they put on. So everyone that's ever taken a stab at the song has rewritten the words. I mean, it all follows the same theme, but they're following a theme that has, you know, slight differential on, you know, what happens to Stagger Lee and, you know, what happens to Billy the Lion. And so it's always interesting to see what different people's takes are on it. But it's one of those songs where I think there's a lot of people that are getting royalties from the writing credits of that song.
Yeah, look good, rightfully so. I love that song. You know, it was one of the songs where, you know, you could pretty much always understand the lyrics and follow the story. And, you know, it was, you know, who doesn't like a story like that, right? When the big bad bully gets his comeuppance, this time from the woman. So all the better.
Well, I love the closing of that song, too, is one of the most powerful, especially in the early, like, late 80s, early 90s. The way they'd stretch it out and give the bam ba bam ba bam din 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 bam ba bam ba bam. It's such a strong first set song, had such a strong close.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with that. And I almost take this as a little inside joke for the Dead that they threw All New Minglewood Blues on there again, right? Because there's always the All New Minglewood Blues, the All Really New Minglewood Blues was on their first album. It's on this album. Yes. It shows.
It's like Famous Ray's Pizza in New York.
Right.
Original Ray's, Famous Ray's, Brand New Ray's, Ray's Cousins Ray's.
Yeah. But look, it's another studio version, and that's fine. And then, of course, If I Had the World to Give, which is, you know, a really, really sweet, beautiful tune that, you know, I love listening to Jerry on. It's a lot of fun and a really, really good one. But, you know, to me, Shakedown Street was significant for two reasons. One, because at least on the album, and we heard it right at the very beginning when we started the show with the introduction to the song Shakedown Street. And if you've ever seen it in concert, it's a very, very powerful, you know, boom with Phil and Jerry all and the drummers coming together at once to really launch it. And it, you know, it takes off and it just has a tremendous amount of energy. It fills the room and it's a great way to start a show or start a set. And it's even fun if you pick it up in the middle of the set. And yet here, when you hear it, you know, it's kind of almost got that disco bong, 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 you know, I don't know how to describe it, sound that's very distinctive for that time of, you know, time of the...
Very much a disco beat, 100% a disco
right,
beat.
Right. It is, and it just is, it's so different from the way the song is actually played in concert, you know, that not that all the Dead songs aren't to one degree or another, but some of them translate a little bit better, I think, from the album, you know, and keep true to, but I mean, to me, Shakedown Street is just always this just powerful, you know, it's a powerful Jerry anthem instead of, you know, a slow meandering Jerry anthem. And, you know, it's just great the way they all pick up on it and they all join in at the right times. And, you know, Shakedown Street's always, if I go to a show and they play it, that's always going to be a good show.
Word is on the album that Mickey helped co-write Shakedown Street, and you know he did because he loved the disco beats that were coming out from the Bee Gees, and so that was the you know sort of the opening drum beat that he did was a Bee Gees drum beat in the beginning of the song.
Well, there's also some talk that I've heard about over the years where Hunter and Donna suggest, if you listen carefully, that the opening of the song dun 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 is not that much different from Three Blind Mice. Three Blind Mice, and they thought that Jerry might have been, you know, doing a little tongue-in-cheek there and kind of playing on an old tune, and I have to say, I never heard that myself. I probably wasn't thinking about it at the time either, but when I read about that, I remember thinking, yeah, if you go back and listen to it, I suppose that could be there, and I get a kick out of that, you know, whether it's true or not, you know, Jerry's personality was such that many wouldn't have put it past him to be that kind of clever or funny when he was putting a song together. But boy, Shakedown Street just explodes. And then in the same way, I think that, you know, we could say about Fire on the Mountain as well, right? And we're going to actually listen to a little clip of Fire on the Mountain at the end of the show on our way out for everybody. But to me, Fire on the Mountain became such an important tune, not just because it meant that we just probably 9 times out of 10 heard a killer Scarlet Begonias, but because it is such an amazing tune and really stands on its own. And again, it's another one of those tunes that Jerry didn't write. Mickey wrote it. I love that, you know, that everybody just...
And you've heard the original Mickey,
oh,
right?
Yeah.
You've heard the rap that he does, the fireman, give me your dogs.
Yes, I've heard that version of it. And you know, love it. And as I recall, when the other ones were touring, he kind of slipped back into that version once or twice. But, you know, to me, it's such a standard Garcia, you know, huge number, right? People would say, you know, the first notes of Scarlet Begonias, yes, 25 minutes of Jerry, right? Because you knew it was just, he was going to take those two tunes, jam the hell out of them. And he really took Fire on the Mountain, made it his own. There's some amazing, amazing versions of it out there. This obviously on the album, is a great studio version, but doesn't come close to capturing the magnificence of the tune, even though it is fun to listen to. My all-time favorite Fire on the Mountain is the Egypt shows in 1978 when they came out of the Olin Agha Reed into Fire on the Mountain, and then came out of Fire on the Mountain and transitioned into Iko Iko, right in front of the pyramids and this whole thing. And it's just, the transition between the Fire on the Mountain into the Iko is to me the ultimate definition of space, what space should really sound like, and space in front of, you know, pyramids that are 5,000 years old and who knows what's going on inside of them while the Grateful Dead are playing. And, you know, as long as it's not another one of those things with Brandon Fraser and Rachel Weisz and all of a sudden the mummies wake up and go wild, although if anything was going to wake them up, it would be that. But yeah, those are just great tunes, and it's just wonderful, you know, to be able to go back to their source and see what they're all about and where they came from, and it's just amazing. But since I know we're going to run short on time today, and I want to make sure we get all of this in, the one thing I was going to say is that to me, what the album signified is another slight transition in the playing style of the Grateful Dead, right? We talked about it going from Primal Dead to kind of American folk and blues and American Beauty and Working Man's. And then with Disco Dead, it was kind of like, you know, they were going in another direction that it seemed to me, at least, they kind of followed through on and Go to Heaven, the same kind of almost, and even their next album.
But so are the Rolling Stones. I mean, they're doing Some Girls and Tattoo You, and like, you know, you look at that same era, there's a lot of bands that were like straight rock and roll bands or blues bands. I mean, the Stones to me are, you know, a pure blues band for years. And then they went into like a straight disco phase that was, you know, and by the way, I love that phase of their catalog as well. So it's not just the Dead that we're doing. I think if the Beatles were still together, they probably would have gone into a disco phase too.
Well, and we forgot the most important part of all of it, which is who the producer of the album is, of course. And that's, you know, we can't talk about
Lowell George, man.
Our good buddy Lowell George from Little Feat. And to this day, I've probably told this story on this show before, but my all-time favorite Grateful Dead story is the story Lowell George talks about the first time he showed, where was this, at their Front Street recording studios, and he walks in and the whole gang is all gathered there, and he said he walked in and he saw everybody down on their hands and knees on the floor and he couldn't figure out what was going on, and they said, oh, we just had a huge tray of cocaine and one of the guys walked by and knocked it off and it fell into this shag carpeting and they were all down there storing it up. And so somebody said to Lowell George, what did you? He goes, what do you mean? I dived down there on the floor with him and, you know, started snorting it up with him. And I, you know, right. I love that story.
Any guy that can popularize weed, whites, and wine is certainly going to get down on his hands and knees and start snorting blow off a shag carpet.
No doubt, even if unfortunately it may have all led to his early demise. And, you know, that was, we can talk about him one day because he's a whole episode all by himself. But he is the producer of this album. And to me, that just makes it a very special, unique album and gives it a great sound. You know, the vote for me is excellent album. Would rather hear Shakedown Street in concert, but every now and then it's great to hear them on the album like that and, you know, really get a chance to kind of play around with them. Moving on really quickly. So now, right, so transitioning there into kind of like, you know, the end of the 70s, early 80s. So now we're going to drag you back to the beginning of the 70s for a minute and highlight a show that's 50 years old today. And really, as much as any show from that era, really kind of represents the pivot point between Primal Dead and the new, you know, Americana version of the Grateful Dead. And, you know, given that it's towards the end of 1971, the Americana version is strongly flexing its muscles and, you know, makes up the majority of the tunes. But for me, what makes this album, this show, I mean, this release just so incredibly special is that right in the middle of playing in the band and dealing Jack Straw and Loser and Beat It On Down the Line, all of a sudden we see the boys completely shift gear out of that period of time, go back, throw in their 1968-69 hats, and come out with a Dark Star that's just tremendous and just keeps building and building and building. And then I don't know how else to describe it, because, you know, there's so many things that you imagine the Grateful Dead coming into out of Dark Star, St. Stephen, the 11, millions of different possible combinations. And on this night, they headed right into, well, Dan, go ahead and play it. Thank you. Okay, so Rob, here's the million-dollar question. How do you go from the depths of an incredible Dark Star jam into a cowboy song?
Because nothing says psychedelia like Marty Robbins.
Yes. Oh, my goodness. That's
it's
great.
It's just such a great pairing of just taking, you know, as you said, the depths of psychedelia and a Dark Star and then coming back out and throwing a classic Marty Robbins El Paso into the mix. It's terrific. And the other thing I love about this show also, Larry, is the fact that, you know, right in the middle of the second set, before they go into, the Going Down the Road, Not Fade Away, Johnny Be Good, they threw in a China Cat jam, like a 30-second China Cat jam, that with no China Cat anywhere in the set, just very, very clearly a 30-second China Cat riff, which is a really unique thing as well, because you just don't see that in too many of their shows. There's a couple things in this one where you're like scratching your head going, that was definitely different.
No doubt. And just to finish up on that other thought for a minute, you know that when they're done with El Paso, they just slip right back into Dark Star. We're just going to quickly say goodbye to Rob Hunt, who's hopping off. Rob, we'll talk to you next week. Safe travels. So we'll finish up here with this. But yeah, you go back from El Paso back into Dark Star. So it's not just, we're playing this great show, Dark Star into the Cowboy Jam, and then off for the rest of the show like that. No. They bring it specifically right back into Dark Star. And then they drop off into Casey Jones and eventually one more Saturday night. And then the second set is very much a more of a modern day, if you will, Dead set with the tunes that we all know and love and go forward, including a Me and Bobby McGee, which is kind of, unique for that time era. And we didn't get to hear that very often. Either way, it's a great show. 11/15/71. It's 50 years old today. Grateful Dead, the Road Trip Series, Volume 3, Number 2. You can find it anywhere. I'm sure it's online as well. Listen to the Dark Star El Paso, Dark Star Casey Jones. You'll love it. If you have time, listen to the whole show. You'll love that too. So a lot covered today, a lot of great stuff. But before we blow out of here and leave you with one final taste of Disco Dead, I'm going to do a little bit of, I guess, what in this industry they call tease, what I'm hoping is going to be our show next week, and if not next week, certainly within a week or so. We've had a brief introductory discussion about this year's Grateful Dead box set, Listen to the River, the seven-show compilation from St. Louis in 71, 72, and 73. But we haven't really spent a lot of time talking about necessarily the significance of St. Louis to the Grateful Dead and some of the great things that happened to them in that town and while they were there that we think endeared them to the city, and I would like to think vice versa. But the release of this box set has brought forth a whole bunch of attention to all of these other little events that happened in St. Louis in and around that time that have connections to the Grateful Dead. And David Lemieux himself, on one of his podcasts when he was introducing this box set to the Dead world, even made mention of something that up to this point I think may have just been more of an urban legend and rumor, and that is the Grateful Dead showing up and making an appearance at a local bar mitzvah party that happened to be taking place in the ballroom of the hotel that they were staying at, I'm presuming before a show started, but possibly after, who knows what their timing was. It's out there, and I had actually heard a story about this 30, 35 years ago, but was never able to independently verify it myself. And now here it is being talked about by David Lemieux. Somebody found an old newspaper article that talks about it. But we here on the Deadhead Cannabis Show are going to scoop the world and really get to the bottom. And next week we will be interviewing not only an individual who was at the show, a very, very credible young man, maybe not so young anymore, but he certainly was at the time. And he'll be able to give us all the details of it. But even better than that, we are hopefully also going to have on the show a gentleman who at the time was a member of the local high school band that was, in fact, the regular entertainment for the evening and was able to interact with the Grateful Dead on the stage that had been set up for this high school band, rock and roll band, to perform for the people who were coming to the bar mitzvah party. So it's going to be a great story. It's the Dead Show that you've probably never heard about, and we're going to bring it to you. So please be sure to tell your friends, and don't miss it. Listen in, and it'll be a good time. So once again, to all of our listeners this week, thank you so much, everyone, for listening. As always, we really, really appreciate it. Please tell your friends. Please tell your family. Please tell anybody out there who likes the Grateful Dead or likes marijuana. We're easy to find, mjbulls.com and lots of other places. We will be back next week with Rob Hunt back again. Jim Marty should be back from the road, so we will be getting his input in again as well. But otherwise, as we sign off here, we're going to leave you with the Grateful Dead playing Fire on the Mountain on the Shakedown Street album, and you'll have a chance to really hear, once again, that Shakedown sound, and then just go listen to any Scarlet Fire from later on in the Dead era and compare the two, and you'll really be amazed. Have a great week, everyone. This is Larry Mishkin signing off, reminding you, please enjoy your cannabis responsibly. Thank you. Get up, get up.